Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books Network channel, New Books in South Asian Studies. I am Shitin Jain, a master's student at the University of Oxford. And in this episode, we are hosting Dr. Jason Birch, who will be discussing his 2024 book, The Amar Guha and Amar Guha Prabodha of Gorakshnath, The Genesis of Hatha and Raj Yoga, which has been published by the French Institute of Pondicherry. Dr. Jason Birch is a scholar of medieval Hatha Yoga and a founding member of SWASIS, the Center for Yoga Studies. He completed his DPhil from the University of Oxford in 2013 and joined the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies as a research fellow in the following year. From 2015 onwards, he took part in a five-year Hatha Yoga project at SWAS, where he located and translated early yoga manuscripts. Apart from his academic works, Dr. Birch also teaches online courses on yoga, merging his practical experience with academic knowledge of its history with Jacqueline Hargreaves on The Luminescent. Thank you very much, Dr. Birch, for accepting our invite and being here on New Books Network. I look forward to having a wonderful discussion with you.
Thanks very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure.
So to begin with our discussion, Dr. Birch, can you tell the audience about the yoga traditions of India, as well as about the Hatha Yoga tradition of India?
Yes. So I suppose Hatha Yoga is really the focus of my book. I mean, the subtitle of the book is The Genesis of Hatha and Raja Yoga. And the reason I called it that is because the text that I edited and translated is one of the first texts to teach these two yogas together, Hatha and Raja Yoga. So to understand the text and its historical context, I'm really looking at how these two yogas emerged and came together. So Hatha Yoga is essentially a type of yoga that emphasizes the practice of physical techniques. And these physical techniques are essentially a sort of postural practice, asanas, if for those who know something of yoga, which in the beginning are mainly seated poses like the lotus pose, Padmasana, or Siddhasana, another cross-legged position, which are done for breathing exercises, pranayama. And, you know, as Hatha Yoga developed, these also started to include non-seated poses, such as balancing on the hands, twisting the body, and so forth. And it also includes the physical practice. It also includes mudras. And these are essentially in the earliest phases of this type of yoga, sort of complex practices, complex postural practices that involve holding the breath and applying internal muscular locks. In the very beginning, there are two of these. It's the chin lock, where you press the chin down onto the chest, and there's the root lock, where you grip the pelvic floor muscles. And that's done during a breath retention. As Hatha Yoga developed, the range, or the, if you like, the repertoire of mudras increased to include other bodily positions, such as inverting the body, hanging the body upside down, as in a pose such as a headstand or shoulder stand, that's Viparita Karani, or a practice such as putting the tongue in the nasopharyngeal cavity, which is above the uvula. That's called Kheechari Mudra. So, yes, it's a physically orientated type of yoga, and the earliest evidence that we have for the term itself, Hatha Yoga, which literally means the yoga of force or yoga by force, is around the 8th, 9th and 10th century in tantric literature, actually Buddhist tantric literature. And there in Vajrayana texts, it's a yoga of last resort, not always described, mentioned by name. And by last resort, I mean that if the main techniques of the tantra fail or don't work, then the sadhaka is told as a last resort to practice hatha yoga. It's with a commentary on the Kala Chakra Tantra, written around the 11th century, that we get a description of hatha yoga in that context. And there, it's the restraint of sexual fluids and the practice of focusing on the internal resonance called nada. Yeah, so it's in the Kala Chakra Tantra that we get an early definition of hatha yoga that involves the practice of fusing the mind with the internal resonance of the body and restraining bindu, sexual, or if you like, generative fluids. But then it's after that point where the term hatha yoga is appropriated by Shaiva traditions. And that's where we start to get texts, such as the one I've edited and translated for my recent book called the Amaralga, which teaches four types of yoga: mantra, laya, hatha, and raja yoga. And hatha yoga, as well as mantra and laya, are a means to achieving raja yoga. Raja yoga literally means the king yoga, but it's understood as the king of all yogas. So, and that's because basically it's the goal of other yogas. And it was essentially a Shaiva interpretation of samadhi. So samadhi, of course, is a state of meditative absorption. So hatha yoga came to represent physical practices that could achieve that state of meditative absorption called samadhi. And raja yoga was the practice and the attainment of samadhi itself. So the Amaralga is the first Shaiva work that we have that teaches a system of yogas combining hatha and raja yoga. And it's an important text because it enables us to see how the physical practices that became hatha yoga were appropriated from a Buddhist milieu, because it so happens that we also have a text, a Buddhist Vajrayana work, that teaches the physical practices of hatha yoga in the Amaralga. The Vajrayana work is called the Amrita Siddhi, and it dates probably to the 11th century. It doesn't call its yoga hatha yoga, but the practice that it teaches, which involves three mudras done in sequence, and then four stages of yoga that result from that practice. And the stages of yoga include the piercing of knots, various resonances that arise within the body, different, if you like, void-like meditative states. These are exactly the same, with a few variations as to what we find in the Amaralga. And it also seems likely that these two texts were composed in the same part of India, South India, northern Kerala, around Mangalore. So it gives us a sort of a window onto how the physical practices moved from a Vajrayana milieu to a Shaiva milieu, how within Shaivism they were combined with Raja Yoga, a Shaiva interpretation of samadhi. And then after that, of course, we start to see these two yogas developing in different ways until we reach an iconic text such as the Hatha Pradipika, which was composed in the 15th century.
Thank you very much for this detailed answer, Dr. Birch. So, while I was reading your introduction, you spent some time discussing the meaning of the name Amar Guha, and I found it interesting. So, can you tell us a bit more about it? Like, what symbolic meaning or significance does the name Amar Guha has?
Yes, well, it has several meanings, really. I mean, literally, Amaralga means a stream of immortals, alga meaning stream, immortals, Amara. And so it refers to the lineage of siddhas, of perfected yogis, who were pioneers, if you like, or the forerunners to the type of yoga that it teaches. But within the text itself, it says that Raja Yoga, the most important yoga that it teaches, is called Amaralga. So there it's basically saying that the main teaching of this lineage of siddhas, of perfected yoga yogis, is the practice of Raja Yoga. Beyond that, it also, I think, is redolent of some of the practices of nectar that are in the text. I mean, alga in the sense of stream or flood, and amara as the, I suppose, immortals, but here perhaps also referring to the nectar of immortals. As we see in the text, part of the practice of Raja Yoga, which involves uniting Shiva and Shakti, part of that practice is melting the moon that's in the head, this reservoir of nectar that then floods the body. And the practice of Laya Yoga also involves visualizing the flow of nectar within the body. So these connotations, I think, are probably evoked by the word Amaralga.
Thank you very much for the answer, Dr. Birch. You mentioned that Amarok shows certain Buddhist influence. So can you please elaborate on this? And adding on to this, from these Buddhist influences, what can we infer about the interactions between the Vajra and Shaiva lineages on the basis of the text we are talking about?
Yes, well, as I mentioned earlier, because we know that the physical techniques came from a Vajrayana tradition, as taught in the text, the Amrita Siddhi, whose teachings are attributed to Virupaksha, the Siddha. Because of that, we can see that really Hatha Yoga emerged from a dialogue between Vajrayana and Shaiva communities. And in a sense, this is no surprise with the Siddha lineage itself, seeing that some of the Siddhas sort of have a Buddhist history, if you like, or a Buddhist presence, as well as a Shaiva one. What can we see? Well, we from this interaction, we can see to some extent how Shaivas changed the yoga that they borrowed. We can see that within the Amaralga, the physical practices and the four stages of yoga that follow take on a subordinate role, an auxiliary. They're an auxiliary practice. In fact, they're one of three yogas that are intended for a student to achieve Raja Yoga. And the structure of four yogas itself seems to rely upon four grades of student. The least capable student being given mantra yoga and the most capable being given Raja Yoga. So the implication there is if you have an exceptional student who can practice Raja Yoga, then Hatha Yoga is not necessary at all. We can also see that a lot of the terminology that was borrowed from the Amaralga, by the Amaralga from the Amrita Siddhi, was terminology that Shaivas were to some extent familiar with, and terminology that they weren't familiar with was dropped. So within Vajrayana Buddhism, there's a concept of four moments. That concept was never really adopted by Shaivism. So the terms for those four moments are written out of the Amaralga, even though the verses themselves are quite, and the four stages of yoga are quite similar. And there's, if you like, remnants of those terms, but they're just used differently, obviously hoping that Shaivas would interpret them differently. But terms that Shaivas were familiar with, such as Ananda, Mahananda, Paramananda, more generic, which had more generic meanings, they were retained. And so they're found in both the Amrita Siddhi and the Amaralga.
Thank you very much for the answer, Dr. Birch. My next question is about the dating of Amar Guha. Can we ascribe a safe date or a safe range of time period for Amaralga? Like, what has been the scholarly debate on the subject, and what is your own take on this?
Well, I assign it to around the 12th century. I think it was composed close to the time of the Amrita City, and the Amrita City has a solid date because there exists a manuscript with both Sanskrit and Tibetan transliteration and Tibetan translation that was composed in the 11th century, dated to the 11th century. So we know that the Amrita City was being transmitted at that time, and so I would say that the Amaralga was probably composed, if not in at that time, maybe a little later. But for to be on the conservative side of things, let's say the 12th century. The upper limit, though, in terms of placing verses within the Amaralga in another text that then enables us to sort of set a firm date is the Hatha-Pradipika, and that's the 15th century. Nonetheless, I think we can also say it's a very early text because the four yogas that it teaches and the practice that it teaches, which I said is just three mudras, really in a sense is a very basic, if you like, fundamental practice that later texts on Hatha and Raja Yoga seem to elaborate upon. A good example is the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, where these three mudras taught in the Amaralga, called Mahamudra, Mahabandha, and Mahamudra, are expanded into a repertoire of 10 mudras. So if we assume that, a basic practice tends to grow over time as people add material, add more practices, add more ideas and techniques. Well, then it seems likely, I would say, that the Amaralga predates the other Hatha and Raja texts that we have because it's teaching a very basic practice. Another point to be made about that is it teaches only two of the bandhas. These are the internal locks that are applied during a breath retention, the chin lock and the root lock in this case. Well, other later Hatha texts teach three bandhas. They add Uddiyana bandha, which is a sort of an abdominal movement that's also done during a breath retention. So I think quite archaic. In fact, as I argue in the book, the verses themselves could be older than those in the Amrita City. I mean, the Amrita City is a very polished and cohesive text, and I would say it's been subject to redacting and rewriting to perhaps take older material and make it more intelligible. A lot of the verses that we have in the Amaralga are very brief and obscure in some ways. And they're talking about the same physical practices, and yet, a section in the Amrita City that may be 10 or 15 verses long is compressed into two or three verses with the Amaralga. Well, that's if the author of the Amaralga was aware of the Amrita City, it's very unusual for a redactor to take material and try and compress it, making, various things difficult to understand. Usually, redactors expand upon older material. So I'd say what has happened is that the Amaralga has probably used as a source an older Vajrayana work, and that this older Vajrayana work was probably a source for the Amrita City, and the author of the Amrita City took that work and expanded on it and made it more intelligible. That doesn't mean the Amaralga was composed before the Amrita City. I'm just suggesting that it probably used a source that was older than than the material that we see in the Amrita City.
Right. And you mentioned that the later text like Hatha-Pradipika mentioned three type of knots, adding abdominal knots to the two knots mentioned in Amaralga. Am I right?
Bandhas. So these are the practice of the bandhas, literally locks, performed during a breath retention, and they're performed during the mudras that are taught in the Amaralga, and the same mudras are also taught in the Hatha-Pradipika, though the practice changed from, again, this early time of the Amrita City and the Amaraga, it changed by the 15th century when the Hatha Pradipika was composed. But yes, so they're done during a breath retention. The yogi breathes in. He or she then applies the chin lock, then the root lock, squeezing the pelvic floor muscles, and then draws the navel in towards the spine. That's Uddiyana Bandha. Then at the end of the retention, the yogi emphasizes Uddiyana, so expands the chest a little bit more, tries to keep that expansion, releases the chin lock, and slowly exhales.
So thank you very much, Dr. Birch. So adding on to this, I would like to ask that within the medieval texts on yoga, like the names you have mentioned, do you see a gradual but subsequent development of certain thoughts, and do you see a diversity among them in regards with their principles in their practices?
Yes, particularly in the early period, I think the Hatha texts have a lot of diversity to them. Take, for example, this system of four yogas that I mentioned. So in the Amaralga, that system seems to be based on four types of student. Depending on their capabilities, they're given a particular yoga to practice. And if it's mantra, lyre, and hatha yoga, they practice that yoga until they achieve Raja yoga. Well, in the Yoga Bija, the same four yogas are taught, but they're taught as a sequential practice where the student starts with mantra yoga. That then leads to the practice of hatha yoga, which then leads to lyre yoga and then Raja yoga. And the reason I think the sequence is done that way is because lyre yoga is interpreted as dissolving the mind. In other texts, it's done through simple meditation techniques. This is also the case in the Amaralga. It's just visualizing nectar within the body and Shiva white a white sorry Shiva as a white linga. So it's a visualization practice. And that brings about dissolution of the mind, which is closely associated with Raja Yoga being defined as the cessation of all mental activities, as we see in Patanjali Yoga. So in Patanjali Yoga, we have Chittavritti Nirodha, cessation of mental activity. In the Amaralga, we have Chittavritti Rahita, without mental activities, pretty much the same thing. So yes, the four yogas are taught differently in those two texts. In another early text, the Yogacaravali, it seems that mantra and lyre yoga are dropped altogether, and we just have hatha and raja yoga being taught. Hatha yoga as the sole means, if you like, to achieving raja yoga, and that's the basic format that was adopted in the Hatha Pradipika. What the Hatha Pradipika did was take the diversity that we see in some of the earlier texts and brought them together within a framework of Hatha and Raja Yoga. Hatha Yoga being the practice of asanas, including some complex asanas, pranayama being the practice of kumbhakas. Eight kumbhakas are taught, and as a preparatory practice to that, we have, six therapeutic techniques called the Shatkarma for students who have too much fat or phlegm and can't do the pranayamas until they've healed themselves. The practice of mudras, but by the time of the Hatha Pradipika, there's 10 of them. And then Raja Yoga is basically the practice of Nardana or Sandana, meditating on the body's internal resonance. So yes, there is development over time. There's variety, as I mentioned, and there's development. With the development, I'd say it's mainly the addition of more techniques, such as the inclusion of more asanas. The inclusion of the eight kumbhakas, and also more mudras, and also, I suppose, in a sense, more explanation and theory on a practice such as Nardana or Sandana. So, to give an explanation of that, in the Amaralga, we have, as I mentioned, a series of stages of yoga that arise from the practice, from the physical practice of Hatha. And with each of these stages, a different resonance arises. Within the Hatha Pradipika, we get that account, same account with the four stages of yoga. But then after that, Svatmarama, the author of the Hatha Pradipika, gives another account with 10 sounds. And those 10 sounds are categorized as into three levels, if you like, coarse, medium, and subtle. And then Svatmarama gives different ways of practicing with these sort of subtle, intermediate, and coarse sounds. So a lot more information as the texts go on, more information is given, greater variety of practice. Absolutely.
Thank you very much for the answer, Dr. Birch. As the Hatha Yoga project itself was concerned about, and you in particular have focused on manuscript research. So I am assuming that must have involved tracing untraced and undiscovered manuscripts. So how was your experience with that? Can you tell us your journey about manuscripts and discovering of manuscripts?
Well, it's certainly very exciting to find a manuscript of a text that no one studied before. That for me is as good as it gets, as good as the work that I'm doing ever gets. It's absolutely exhilarating, and it's also very exciting to find a new manuscript of a text that I know and have been working on, but want to continue working on by perhaps producing an edition or a translation. Because with each manuscript, handwritten manuscript is unique. It has unique readings. It has a life of its own in many cases. I mean, there are instances where you might find a manuscript that's a copy of another manuscript that you've already got, and that's disappointing often, although it can still be handy if the other manuscript is damaged or has problems with it. Well, then the copy may help you solve some of those problems. But it's for me a wonderful way to balance the library work, or the work at the desk, if you like. When I say the library work, the work that one might do at one's sort of university library or at home, which is sort of more routine, and then of course when you go to India, travel to India and visit new libraries, see new collections, and then maybe discover manuscripts, new manuscripts of texts that you're working on, or a manuscript of a new text. That to me is it's a wonderful adventure. It sort of adds a whole other dimension to the work. There's the thrill of discovery, the thrill of travel, the thrill of meeting new people. That's also been a wonderful part of my work in India. The people that I meet at the libraries are often very interesting. They could be scholars themselves, or if they're librarians with a lot of experience with manuscripts, I can learn a lot from them about local collections, the local manuscripts that they have, and so forth. They'll often introduce me to scholars working in my area or related in some way related to the work that I'm doing, and that can lead to great interactions, discussions, and so forth. They may recommend places to visit, other libraries or historical sites that are important. So I've spent a lot of time doing that type of field work in India. It can it can be a in a, you've got to balance it with the work that you're doing at the desk, with the work that one's doing in terms of writing and editing and translating and so forth. That sort of needs a stable routine, and travel doesn't really provide that. So when traveling in India doing field work, it's often not very productive that way. Yes, I certainly hope I can do more of it, more field work in the future.
Thank you very much for the answer, Dr. Birch, and sharing with us your experience about manuscript research. So my next question is related with your manuscript research. As you mentioned that during your manuscript research, you found two new recensions of Amaroqua, which were previously unknown or undiscovered. So tell me, please tell me that how has it contributed significantly to the ongoing scholarship? And what do these two recensions tell us about the text itself?
Well, before I started working on the Amaralga, one of the recensions was already known, and that was called the Amaralga Praboda. It's mentioned in some library catalogues that date to the early 20th century, and a transcript of it was published by Kalyani Malik in 1954. And her book, I think, has been fairly widely accessible. So the Amaralga Praboda figures in lists of works by siddhas, Goraksha, and so forth, that date to the 70s and the 80s. That was so the Amaralga Praboda is a longer recension than the Amaralga, and it contains verses from other texts that I've worked on, such as the Amanaskar. The Amanaskar is an early Raja Yoga text that I focused on for my doctoral thesis. It dates to around the late 11th, early 12th century. And one of the verses in that text is found in the Amaralga Praboda. The Amaralga Praboda is also quotes explicitly another text called the Sri Samputta. And it also has a verse from the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra in it. It also towards the end of the text, it's quite discursive, so it's clearly a compilation. You can see that the author's drawing material from different sources, and at times in a fairly crude way, trying to sort of cut and paste the material together. So because of that, because of its compilatory nature. I thought that the Amaralga was Praboda was a text composed after the early Hatha and Raja Yoga texts that I knew before discovering the Amaralga. And these were texts such as the Amanaskar, the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, and so forth. So meant that in the scholarship that I wrote from the time of my doctoral thesis through to the Hatha Yoga project, I was dating the Amaralga Praboda to around the 14th century. We still knew, thanks to the work of Christian Bouy, a French scholar who did a lot of textual analysis of yoga texts and the Yoga Upanishads, we still knew that the Amaralga Praboda had material in common with the Hatha-Pradipika, so we were dating it before the 15th century. But when I found the Amaralga, it was a revelation because it was a much shorter text, and the areas that are discursive or borrowing material from places, from texts that I knew were not there. And suddenly the structure of the text became very clear. I could sort of see what the original author had intended. Of course, when you find a manuscript of a shorter text, the concern that's at the back of your mind is that you wonder whether some material's been left out. You know, is it a truncated version? Sometimes we do have texts, usually longer texts, where someone has taken the text and then just reproduced part of it or tried to produce a summary of a longer work. And so I was worried about that to some extent. But then when I found a second manuscript that was not a copy of the first one that I found, and then when I compared the structures and realized that the Amaralga Praboda is really a longer version that's adding more material to what was probably original, then I could see that two recensions of this work existed, and that the short one, the Amaralga, was the early one, probably much closer to the original in terms of its structure, and the Amaralga was a later version where someone had added more material.
Thank you very much for the answer, Dr. Birch. My next question would be that what are the future possibilities in manuscript research in the field of yoga studies or Hatha yoga? Should we expect that there are more texts that need to be retraced, rediscovered, and published, like the ones which you have published?
Well, I've got enough to do in my lifetime. Just based on the field work that I've done, I've got lots of texts to edit and translate. But I would still like to go to India and search for more manuscripts of the texts that I'm working on. But I'm quite confident that I'll also find more material. We have some compendiums, large compendiums that quote texts by name, and it's clear that that there were texts circulating in the 16th and 17th century that we don't have manuscripts for now. If more archival work is done and more searching through library collections happens in the future, I'm quite sure that new texts will be found. And usually when a new text is found, it fills in another part of the history. I'm quite sure actually that we only have a fraction of probably what was written in the medieval period. Texts fall out of use if the manuscripts disappear, a manuscript's life, particularly in South India, if it's a palm leaf manuscript, might be 200 or 300 years. If it's paper, maybe it's 300 or 400 years. But even then, of course, manuscripts can be damaged, destroyed by water and fire and so forth. So I'm quite sure that we've lost a lot of material. And the beauty about India, the amazing thing about India's current library collections is that they're vast, absolutely huge, throughout the country, and that there are thousands and thousands of manuscripts that haven't been properly studied, that have barely been looked at. And so there's an enormous amount of work to do there, and that's why I think it benefits from an international effort, as many people as possible who can do that sort of research and archival work, all collaborating, working together. That's the ideal, really, to bring to light not only texts about yoga, but texts about all sorts of subjects and all aspects of literature that are in archives and haven't been properly studied.
Thank you very much for the answer. I would also request you to tell our audience about a few other scholarly works to which they can refer to in case they are interested in this field or they want to know more.
The two books that I've mentioned so far is, of course, my book on the Amaralga, which talks about how Hatha and Raja Yoga came together and were taught as a pair of yogas. And then James Mallinson and Peter Santow's book on the Amrita Siddhi, which provides an edition and translation of the Buddhist Vajrayana work that describes the physical practices and the stages of yoga that follow from it. There's also a lot of academic articles that I and others working in the field have written, and they're available on academia.edu. On Hatha yoga, James Mallinson has produced many, many articles. There's really a growing number of scholars in the field. There's more PhDs being completed that are now available online, like Seth Powell has just produced a dissertation along with an edition and translation of a Shaiva yoga text that teaches Hatha and Raja Yoga called the Shiva Yoga Pradipika. There's better primers, if you like, better sort of secondary sources that are describing the broader history of yoga and how Hatha and Raja Yoga fit into it. Of course, Roots of Yoga is probably the best one available. Stuart Sarbacher has written a book on the sort of the general history of yoga that's available. And I think we're also starting to see, of course, people in other areas, whether it's Vedanta or Tantra, and even medicine, Ayurveda, we're starting to see scholars in other areas looking at the relationship of their subject to yoga. So Dominic and Dagmar Wyasik are a good example of that. They work in the field of Indian medicine. Dagmar Wyasik works with more in alchemy, Rasa Shastra, and they've both led projects that, well, in Dagmar's case, looked at the what she called the entwined history of yoga and medicine. And then she's, of course, been doing work on alchemy. And Dominic Wyasik has looked at passages on yoga in Ayurvedic works, such as the Charaka Samhita. And he's also done a fair bit of scholarship on the Patanjali Yoga Shastra itself. For the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, of course, we can't go past the work of Philip Muss, who's been working on a critical edition of the work and has really found parallels, textual parallels between the Yoga Shastra and other works written at that time that's enabled him to date the text more accurately. Tantric yoga is an area that, that really has made huge strides over the last 10 years, with the work of Somdev Vasudeva writing about the yoga of the Malini Vijayotara Tantra. And of course, having been in his dissertation, it was his thesis, but he's then published it as a book. He has a very broad introduction, really, about tantric yoga as a whole. Alexis Sanderson himself has the teacher of a lot of the people I've just mentioned, such as myself, James Mallinson, and Somdev. He's done a translation of the Rigendra Tantra's section on yoga, the Yoga Pada. Dominic Goodall, of course, has worked on yoga texts, tantric yoga texts, or should I say tantras that have a section on yoga in them. He's currently working on a chapter of one of the Shiva Dharma texts, the Shiva Dharmottara, that's on yoga. So that'll be very interesting when he publishes that. And I think, of course, the other thing to mention is that there's been a lot of work on the history of modern yoga over the last 15 years, and that, of course, helps us to understand the more ancient history, the classical and medieval history, and its relation to what we're seeing in the 20th century and today. Elizabeth de Michellis was at the forefront of that research with her book, The History of Modern Yoga, and then many of her students have taken up that work and produced excellent books, such as Mark Singleton, Suzanne Newcombe, and others. So, yes, and modern yoga, or the research into modern yoga, has been a very vibrant area of study, with a lot of new scholars, young scholars, studying a different type of yoga, modern yoga, or a different aspect of how it's developed over the centuries. We're also seeing more scholars looking at the history of yoga within their own country, whether it's a different, particular part of Europe, or Asia, or even Australia. So there's a lot of exciting work being done, and I think in the future, the next 5 to 10 years, as long as the funding keeps keeps coming, we'll see more work being produced and published.
Sure. Thank you very much for the answer, Dr. Birch. And to wrap the interview up, I would ask one final question to you about your future academic works. Like, should the what are the works you are planning to publish, which we should wait for?
Oh, well, I'm just about to publish a book on the asanas of the Yoga Chintamani. The Yoga Chintamani is a large Sanskrit compendium on yoga that was written in the late 16th or early 17th century in Varanasi by a sannyasin named Shivananda Sarasvati. And it's a very large text as a whole that covers just about every topic of yoga that you could think of. But I found a unique manuscript that has a long recension of this compendium where, a scribe or a redactor took the original work and then added a lot of notation, a lot of annotations to it. And in the section on asana, which is quite sizable in the original work, it teaches 33 or 34 asanas, mainly sort of compiled from older sources. The redactor of this unique manuscript added a lot of material, added at least 20, 25 descriptions of asanas, then a table of 84 names, and then a longer list of about 110 names. And much of that material is unknown from other sources. It's new, if you like, to modern scholarship. So I've written a book that looks at this sort of long section of asana in a manuscript of the Yoga Chintamani, tries to provide some historical context for the original work, who the author was, when it was written, what's in the original text, what the author's agenda was, all that type of thing. And then I look at this large compilation and discuss why it's special. I think its historical importance lies in the fact that we start to see around the 16th and 17th century more and more asanas, more yoga postures being adopted by different yoga traditions, whereas the earlier traditions of Hatha and Raja yoga taught hardly any asanas at all, maybe one or two. Well, by the 16th and 17th century, we're getting lists of 84 or more postures and descriptions of many complex asanas that are, certainly being done for reasons other than pranayama and meditation. They're being done probably because they heal illnesses and help to achieve some of the yogic aims, such as awakening Kundalini and so forth. So that book I hope will be published in a couple of months' time. I'm also working on another early modern text called the Hatha Paddhati. I've been working on that for a while, and I hope to get that finished by the end of this year. Working on an earlier text called the Yoga Bija. All of these texts were part of the Hatha Yoga project. So during the time of that project, I was able to collect more manuscripts, produce rough drafts of an edition, read it with a group of specialists, which is, a wonderful thing to be able to do if one's editing a text, is to read it with others, other specialists, other experts, and get feedback from different perspectives on what you're doing. So a lot of that work I'm now trying to finish, and these three texts, the Yoga Chintamani, the Yoga Bija, and the Hatha Vyasapaditi, are the next ones that I'm likely to finish. Since the Hatha Yoga project finished, though, I've been involved in two other projects, the Hatha Pradipika project, which is a collaboration between, well, it was a collaboration between SOAS, the University of London, and Marburg University. We worked, James Mallinson and myself worked with three scholars from Marburg, led by Professor Jürgen Haneder, who provide a lot of the expertise that we needed on how to handle a large number of manuscripts to work out a feasible stemma so that we could identify an early recension of the work and narrow down the number of manuscripts that we needed to collate and work on. And that project finished at the beginning of this year, and the edition and translation should be finalized in the next month or so. In fact, there's a draft version of it available online, a beta version, if you like to use that sort of computer language. It's a very rough version that we've put online so that we can work out some of the bugs that we're facing and tweak the software to get it working the way we want. That's people can look at that on hatapradipika.online. I've also been working with Dr. Shaman Hatley for another project on the Yoga Chintamani, the text that I mentioned. So for the Hatha Yoga project, I worked on a section of the long recension on asanas. But of course, I was reading other parts of the text. Shaman attended the workshop, a lot of the workshops that we had for the Hatha Yoga project. He found the Yoga Chintamani very interesting, and so he proposed that we put together a proposal to get funding to translate, to edit and translate the whole work. And that proposal was successful. It was funded by the National Endowment of Humanities in America, and it's hosted at the University of Massachusetts, where Shaman has a position. We've been translating the text where it's a very long text. It has four chapters. And we're getting, I think, we're probably two-thirds or maybe three-quarters of the way through the first chapter, and the project's been going for just over a year now. So a lot of work to do there, but it's very, I think we have a, you know, we have a good method of working. We've honed in on a couple of very important manuscripts, and you know, I think we'll produce a good edition and translation with the method that we're using. So yes, in the future, that's what people can expect to see from me.
Well, it seems like we should expect a lot of publications on important works in yoga studies from you. We will be certainly eager to look forward to them and to read them. It will certainly be a very important contribution to the ongoing discourse on yoga studies. So I think with this, we should wrap the interview up. Thank you very much, Dr. Birch, once again for accepting our invite and being here on NBN today. It was fantastic talking to you. And we wish you all the best for your upcoming endeavors and your upcoming academic projects. We look forward to hosting you again on one of your upcoming publications.
Okay, thank you. My pleasure. Thanks again for the invitation and the interview.
Thank you very much.